Rachel Kelly is a best-selling writer, public speaker, and mental health campaigner. She writes regularly for the press and gives TV and radio interviews to help educate and break down the stigma around mental illness in her role as an ambassador for several mental health charities. She's been on Radio Gorgeous many times, and today we're talking about, I think it's fourth or fifth book. It's called You'll Never Walk Alone, Poems for Life's Ups and Down, published by Hodder. Hi, Rachel. Warm welcome back.
Oh, well, it's lovely to be back, and thanks for reaching out and connecting, because we always have a great connection, I feel.
We do. Now, can you tell us about the book, how it's laid out?
Yes, so the book came about really because of my mum's death 4 years ago. And I had previously written about poetry, so this book isn't an anthology. It's a book in which I do share the poems, but I also write about them. And I think I'd written about poetry before, about poetry for consolation and allowing feelings of sadness. But this book is also about allowing poetry for joy, because I think that's what my mum's death taught me, is life's short and we've got to inhabit moments of joy. And so, yes, in terms of the structure of the book, I've laid it out using this idea of sort of seasons of your mind. So winter of discontent, in Shakespeare's famous phrase, a sort of spring of hope, a summer of joy, a autumn of reflection. And each of the four seasons are really about allowing and inhabiting those feelings and those moods, because what I found in my own life is that I'm often in my head and that feelings are frightening, or can be, even joyful feelings. But these are poems that allow us to go into very deep feelings and all kinds of feelings, rather than, thinking we've just got to be happy all the time, basically.
So you haven't, there's a page with the poem on it, and then next to it is, you write about it. How is it written in sort of layman's terms? How's it written? How are you trying to communicate to people?
So I'm not really trying to do sort of literary criticism as such. I didn't do English at university. And in a way, for me, my interaction with poetry is very emotional. So it's kind of how it makes you feel. So the poems I've chosen are all ones that for me kind of evoke quite strong feelings. And I suppose what I've been trying to do in my kind of explanations really is, how does this poem nail this feeling? And actually sometimes revealing a little bit of the sort of backstory and legwork of some of the devices that the poem has used to get that feeling across, but also just trying to kind of explain, you know, what emotion is being really sort of plumbed and the depths to which it's been sort of allowed and shared.
Could you say, though, that is what the words have an effect on you? They maybe have a different effect on other people.
I think that's true. I think you're absolutely right. And it's a good point that actually people's response to poetry is very individual. I suppose in choosing the poems, because I've run a lot of poetry workshops over the years, I've tried to select poems that have had a strong reaction and in terms of other people's responses. So, yes, they are my responses. I'll give you an example. I know we were chatting earlier about one of our favourites, which is the Derek Walcott Love After Love. So I remember doing a workshop. So
can you explain the poem? In fact, just read one, you know, not the whole thing.
It's a poem about sort of self-acceptance, really, and sort of allowing a feeling of lovability. And I put it in my autumn section, sort of reflective section. But yes, I suppose the first verse really sums it up. It's called Love After Love by Derek Walcott. The time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome. So I do remember sharing this at one of the workshops. So I tend to do them alongside mental health charities. I had a long stretch working in a particular prison. I'm not allowed to say for security reasons. But I remember a woman reading this poem aloud, because that's the way I structured the workshop. I'd have six or seven poems that would be read aloud and then we'd discuss them. And it was extraordinary because there was this moment after reading this poem when the woman just slowly started to cry. And we were all spellbound, about 20 of us sitting round. And then she just said that after years in and out of the NHS and hospitals and psychiatric help, et cetera, this was a poem that she felt understood, and she used that phrase, and that it just allowed this feeling in her that she was lovable and that she was love, and that she could feel that. And so I suppose that's what I say when you ask, you know, what am I trying to say in the rubrics, as it were? It's how does this poem make us feel loved and lovable? But sometimes, you know, it's just a very strong reaction that you just see in the room, which is extraordinary.
So it's really good. So you've done sort of tests in the real world with these poems.
Yes, I mean, you know, I mean, they do obviously reflect a lot of my own choices, but yes, I mean, you know, there's so many poems that you could choose, and I obviously, you know, have a limited selection. There's sort of more or less 52 of them, but the reason the poems are in there is that they don't just have an effect on me, and actually that's been really lovely since the book's come out, is feeling that other people resonate, and that it has fed into something quite deep with some other readers that can also understand those feelings and maybe possibly allow them for the very first time.
Marvellous. Now, it's called You'll Never Walk Alone. Now, I think of that as a song, especially it's a football anthem, and it's also a musical. Was it written as a... I mean, it is the song You'll Never Walk Alone.
Yes.
Was it written as a poem or was it written as a song?
Yes, I think it's from the musical Carousel. So it was written as a song, but I thought that the central metaphor there was very helpful it was a helpful on lots of levels. I mean, the first obvious idea, that this idea that poems keep you company, and, you know, therapy is fantastic and, you know, other people helping you out, but it was 3 a.m. and you wake up in a sort of cold sweat, feeling desperate, this sense that of companionship, that somebody else has been there and that there's a poet and you can hear those words and feel less alone. But the other reason I was drawn to that is that the central metaphor of that is that there's a storm, and it's kind of keep on going through the storm. But the key point about a storm is a storm passes. And I think that was a very important concept throughout the book, is that, yes, we have these sad times. So I've got a winter section of a lot of more challenging poems, you might say. But built into seasonality is that, you know, obviously after winter comes the spring. And I think sometimes in the mental health discussion, we've almost overly stressed that we've all got to be happy all the time. But the seasonal metaphor just obviously stresses the point that there's this changeability. And so the book is, in a way, is allowing all your feelings and being comfortable with all of them. And that, you know, there's a nice line, I think it's in the Charles Mackey poem, O Ye Tears, and he uses the image of a rainbow, which is that you can't have the rainbow without the rain. Mm. So there's that feeling of allowing and inhabiting and being with all your different feelings, and that mutability and changeability. So I think that's one of the reasons I went for You'll Never Walk Alone.
Just to say, I've had a bad few years recently, and in the last 2 weeks, I've felt hope. And it's the first time I've felt hope for years. And I was having lunch with a friend and I said, oh, I'm feeling hopeful. She said, well, that's very dangerous, hope. And I thought, gosh, is it? What do you think about the word hope or the feeling of hope? Is it?
That's really interesting. I'm a huge believer in hope. I don't really know where we are without hope. I mean, what do I feel about hope? I mean, there's a lovely poem in the book, actually. There's the Emily Dickinson, Hope is the Thing with Feathers.
And that was so charming. Yeah.
Well, what she says in that poem is that it perches in the soul. So it's not like whether it's a good or bad thing. It's just part of us. Mm. And that sometimes if we're feeling hopeless, it's to sort of, in a way, go deeper. And I think that's another way that poetry actually really speaks to me. And my mum always used to say this, is that, you know, in difficult times, go deeper. So I feel there's something there about a kind of pure awareness, a kind of, this might sound a bit overly spiritual, but just this idea that we're all kind of infinite beings and that we can be out of whack and out of alignment and things not going well for us. And often in those states, we feel that there's no hope. But sometimes, and indeed with the help of a poem to give us those words and to go deeper. And often this whole notion of speaking aloud or learning by heart, so the word coeur, coming from courage in the French, is to sort of go into that, a kind of deeper spirituality, really, within ourselves, but also a kind of deeper connectivity to sort of nature and a kind of wider universe, if that doesn't all sound too sort of existential and sort of spiritual. But it's a sort of long-winded answer to your question. But when I think about these things like courage, hope, faith, kindness, compassion, they're within all of us. And sometimes we can't sort of access or feel them. But actually that this feeling of how the some of the poems can make us aware that actually they're all there. They are all there. They're all within us. And we just have to kind of go deeper and find them. And yes, we can be out of whack, but actually no. You know, we're all these sort of infinite beings with a huge capacity for hope.
It's fantastic. Now, you touched on it then. The book, at the end of the book, you kind of give pointers to people of how to kind of access poetry and understand poetry. Can you explain how you've done that?
Yeah, well, I suppose I feel sometimes a little bit I'm like sort of banging the drum, and people wouldn't think that poetry was part of their sort of everyday mental health toolkit. And I'm not saying it's the only thing by any means. You know, we've chatted about some of my other ideas. I'm interested in nutrition and mental health and other strategies. But in terms of using poetry in your everyday life, there are really practical ways you can do it. So there are things like memorizing a poem. There are things like expressive writing, actually writing a poem. So even though this is a book about poetry, what I found in the workshops is by sharing and kind of allowing oneself to sort of be exposed almost to these incredible words, it elicits a response in us that we may want to write. And indeed, the third way is also sharing poetry and using it as a way to kind of connect with others. And I've been interested because I've tried to look at a little bit of the clinical evidence across all these three things. So both memorizing a poem, writing a poem, and sharing a poem. And because more broadly, there are some concerns about some of the aspects of medication, and I'm not saying medication isn't important, but poetry is something obviously without any side effects, and it's not going to be controversial in that way. But there are ways that you can really make it part of your everyday mental health life. And I think I would probably start by just learning something very simple. There are one or two haikus in the book. And memorizing a poem is really interesting as a sort of psychological process. There's one poem which, when my mum died, I really have inside me in a sort of internalized way. So this idea, we all have narratives inside us, and can we shift those narratives? And I know there's things like cognitive behavioral therapy that changing the way we think, but this may be changing our internal stories in a much more visceral and emotional way, working at a much deeper level. So there's this one very brief haiku, and when my mum died, I just kept repeating it, and it's it just goes like this. It's very simple. The temple bell stops, but the sound keeps coming out of the flowers. The temple bell stops, but the sound keeps coming out of the flowers. And for, you know, that really helped me so much with my mum's death, because it's like her bell had stopped, but in that extraordinary image, because obviously sound doesn't come out of flowers. So it's yoking together these two completely different images. You know, we can imagine this temple and the bell and somebody banging the drum, and but it stops. But then this extraordinary idea of the sound keeping coming out of the flowers. And, you know, for me, that has eased the grief around my mum, because I think, no, her spirit's there. The sound keeps on coming out of the flowers.
And the flowers will keep growing. They will grow and die and grow and die, but they will keep growing forever. And
yeah.
That's the thing. But they go through a phase, don't they? They go through life.
Well, that exactly. So you've exactly picked up on the reason I use this idea of the seasons of your mind, because that seasonality of a sort of death but rebirth, and within all death is rebirth. But even just saying it, I feel slightly goosebumpy, and I know it's working on a really different sort of emotional, visceral level. And actually some of the research is that poetry does work on a really different, deeper level. And I think I think it was Eliot who said that poetry is heard and felt before it's understood.
And that's beautiful.
Yeah, and I just love that idea of of working on this really deep, and I think, again, looking at some of the studies, it says that poetry works at a much sort of deeper level of the brain. So maybe this is just where I'm at sort of psychologically at the moment with my mum's death and this stage in our life. It's really interesting. You were saying, you know, you've had a tough 3 years. And I think it is tough for women at this sort of transitional period. Our children are growing up. There's quite a lot of loss around, loss of our parents, loss of a certain identity as mothers.
Loss of children, they're now adults.
Yeah. And so I think having, you know, this book's taken me 4 years, and having written about more practical things, you know, like nutrition and things, in a way, I feel at this stage in my life, I've had to go quite a bit deeper. And the poems have just kept me company as I've gone there.
I'm interested in the word mantra, because maybe these poems are a mantra. They are a mantra, aren't they?
Yeah, I think that's another really practical way you can sort of introduce poetry, is that, so some of the breathing techniques, which I do use a lot to sort of drop into a sort of deeper state of consciousness rather than being on totally on the surface. And I think one of the ways I use the mantra, so it could be one or two sort of healing lines, you know, my strength is made perfect in weakness, or there's a line in one of the poems about breaking into blossom. And it's just the sheer beauty of the words, and just sort of softly repeating that. I mean, I'm sure, you know, obviously with some of the meditation techniques, you repeat an om or a chant, but you could play around and maybe just use a particular line that's just, we were talking earlier about that line, the password is fortitude. You know, the password is fortitude, and just that kind of repetition, and that again internalized that feeling of the line. And the feeling of the connectivity that somebody wrote that, maybe somebody shared it with you, and you do feel more connected. My mum shared that line with me. So there's a sort of feeling of you know, you're less alone. You're connected. That was written by Violet Needham. You know, who knows what state she was in when she decided that the password was fortitude. I mean, there are practical things like writing them on postcards, and I have a few shoved into my bag if I'm headed out into the world and I'm feeling wobbly in the evening. And sometimes I literally physically hold on to them, you know, literally hold on to a card. And again, it's quite physical and on a quite a deep level of feeling that connection. I'm going slightly goosebumpy again, actually. Yeah, it does.
You're
feels
revealing
quite
your authentic self.
Yeah, I suppose. And it's,
been quite hard for you writing this book for that reason, hasn't it?
Well, it has really, because I suppose it is very personal. And this sort of idea that if you reject the book, you reject me. And I've had to really go into some of the sort of philosophy and love in the poems themselves that, you know, not everybody's going to connect with this, and that's okay. For those that do connect, that's a lovely thing. It's something that helps me. I'm sharing it. It may or may not help you, but it isn't. I'm always working on sort of needing outward affirmation and all those sort of things.
You're exposing your soul, your complete inner self. So it's a big thing to share with the world.
Oh, well, thank you for saying that, because I think in the process of writing it, I didn't really sort of quite realise that. And I'm quite surprised by how vulnerable I felt, actually. I know we've talked about needing outward affirmation and approval. And one of the things that I've been really going through in this process of going out there is just feeling good enough that the book is, you know, it is a sort of culmination of, as you say, I am going out there, but at the same time, you know, in the end, most of us, well, for all of us, our main relationships with ourselves. So I just come back and use some of the ideas in some of the poems. I've been using the Inuit prayer a lot, actually, because I've been waking a lot at 3, thinking, oh, does anybody like my book? And think, oh, there I go again, that same old story.
Tell us the Inuit one.
Well, it's a lovely one. It's an Inuit prayer, and it uses a sort of iconography of the Inuit life, so the Eskimos, and there's a full of the fear and doubt, which I can really go into big time despite all this stuff I've done for so many years, but talks about worrying about their kayak being much too far out and all the drama of the huts and the
surviving
journeys.
In that life must be, it's just constant survival.
Constant survival and a sort of fear-driven life. And and I can so easily slip into that. And actually, it's so much the narrative of our world. You know, fear, fear.
Totally.
Panic. Yep. You know, it's not okay.
Yeah. Governments, wars,
yes,
everything
that's
happening.
Yes, we're in a sort of state of of total... And I think fear is such a strong...
Yeah. What's fear the opposite of?
Well, is it the opposite of fear? Is it the opposite? Or is it the opposite of hope? I'm not sure. Or courage? I'm not sure. But the point about that poem is it sets up this sort of fear-driven narrative.
Mm.
But then it goes deeper again. Yeah. And it ends with this lovely image about just being with nature and the great day that dawns each morning. And this sort of idea, we don't have to do anything. We are part of something bigger. And that's really spoken to me recently because I've been sort of rushing off. And
what about the word acceptance for you?
Oh, well, that is absolutely, that's absolutely massive. I mean, I've been working on that. I mean, nearly 60. I've been working on that all my, about to use an expletive. I've been working on that all my life. And I mean, thank goodness some of these poems, they understand that profound need. I mean, I'd say the poem that really gets me every time in terms of acceptance is the Herbert, George Herbert, Love. And you know, he sets up that feeling of not feeling acceptable to oneself or anybody else. So he talks about feeling guilty of dust and sin. I mean, what an amazing description of not feeling good enough, not feeling okay. And it's I'd love to tell you that I don't get that, but I do still get it.
Well, I'm really pleased you're revealing that you're human.
Oh, well, I mean, I know. I just, bloody hell, it is hard work sometimes. Just, but Herbert, he had this stuff too. And he ends in that poem by, you know, sit and eat, you know, a sort of spiritual power. Obviously, he was a religious poet. And he, and the last poem, the last verse is, you know, you are lovable, you are love, and you are okay, and you must sit and eat and taste my meat. And that is in the end a sort of an acceptability that we are all love, we are all lovable. Yes, we can be out of whack. Yes, we can believe a kind of fear-driven narrative. But that's what Herbert ends up with, is that, you know, who made the eyes but I? He's talking about this idea that we're all created by some higher power, i.e. the eyes are our actual eyes, but also the eyes are being. And I suppose there is a deep spirituality that runs through a lot of these poems of feeling more profoundly our place. I mean, Mary Oliver talks about our place in the family of things. The wild geese calling over and over about all of us have a place in the family of things. And this is deep stuff, but I think anybody who feels unlovable, disconnected, which is probably all of us, these are words that give us hope, really.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Rachel Kelly, for coming on to Radio Gorgeous. You'll Never Walk Alone is published by Hodder. And even though I was going to say, go out and buy it a Christmas present, don't, buy it for yourself. Thanks for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
Oh, Josephine, thank you. May you never walk alone.
I feel goosebumps all over now.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's the poems, not me, really.
Well, it's a connection with reality, which is beautiful.
Lovely.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.